Ships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More at mndeerhunters.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Best before date, Minnesota mother Barbie Anderson relies on a federal food aid program to help her buy nutritious foods such as milk, fruits, and vegetables for her children. But the shutdown is threatening that lifeline, and she says it is clear politicians do not understand how much is at risk for millions of families.
And we'll bid a fond farewell to Dennis Trudeau, a longtime CBC broadcaster and former co-host of this program, whose ability to think fast and improvise led a longtime colleague to call him the consummate journalistic piano player.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens on KAXE in a few moments. Support comes from Beltrami Electric, building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Let's take a listen to our album of the week. It's called Cut and Rewind by Say She She. It's the band's third album. They're a trio from New York City, and sonically they draw from soul, disco, and funk through three-part harmonies. The trio writes collaboratively, and for this album, they would write a song and record it that same day, and the rhythm section on this band is all members from the cult funk band Orgone. The song we're going to hear from Say She She is called Take It All.
Everyone around you seems to have better luck. Slowly undoing.
from our album of the week, Say She She, Take It All. The album is called Cut and Rewind. Find more at KAXE.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
In the line of duties, it sure seemed like today's high-stakes meeting between the Prime Minister and the U.S. President went well, but we will ask an international trade consultant what he thinks.
Meal plans. The U.S. government shutdown is threatening an essential food aid program for low-income families. A mother of three says she's rationing her supplies and hoping that the uncertainty ends soon.
Wrong side of the trucks. She was convicted of mischief for her role in the Ottawa protests, but Tamara Leach's lawyer says his client is relieved that today's sentencing did not end with more jail time.
Signing off, we'll pay tribute to longtime CBC broadcaster and former As It Happens co-host Dennis Trudeau. A colleague says he had a voice that sang through the radio.
Chomp and circumstance. An astronomer in Italy recalls the moment he received some unusual data and learned that a rogue planet was devouring gas at a record-breaking rate.
And gut reaction. You'd expect to hear that the runners in a recent ultramarathon ran a lot. You would not expect or want to hear that they had to visit 10 Taco Bells during the race and eat at 9 of them. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that assumes they hurled themselves across the finish line. When Prime Minister Mark Carney walked into his meeting with U.S. President Donald Trump today, the stakes were high, but expectations were not. It was the second White House meeting between the two leaders this year, and with mounting anxiety over U.S.-imposed tariffs, the pressure has been on the Prime Minister to negotiate some kind of deal with the notoriously mercurial Mr. Trump. Here's Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc speaking to reporters after the talks this afternoon.
The conversation, as I said, was more detailed than previous discussions. It concluded with the President and the Prime Minister directing us, me and my colleagues and the President, his cabinet secretaries who were there, and others, to continue the conversation and to quickly land deals that will bring, we think, greater certainty in areas where the principal areas would be steel and aluminum and energy.
Before today's meeting, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre sent a pointed letter to the Prime Minister writing, quote, "No more losing. It is time for you to deliver the promised wins," unquote. Eric Miller is an international trade consultant and the president of the Rideau Potomac Strategy Group. We reached him in Mexico City.
Eric, the minister also used the word successful, positive, substantial to describe what happened today in Washington. But should the folks in all of those industries the minister just listed, should they be holding their breath that some positive change is coming for them soon?
I think there's a good chance that positive change will come. Obviously, the tariffs have been extremely damaging, particularly to steel and aluminum, and it would provide reassurance as well to the energy sector that there will be predictability going forward. But the deal is not done yet, and people in the industry know that until everything is locked down and signed, that they can't take anything to the bank.
So what would you advise? You know, you're in Mexico City. What do you advise people in those sectors, companies that you work with in this current climate, knowing, you know, hearing what you heard there and knowing how today's meeting went?
Well, certainly what is very positive coming out of this meeting is that there have been sectors identified where President Trump and Prime Minister Carney have come away with a clear mission to try to make a deal. What you want to do in a negotiation is to try to take issues off the table. There's still the all-important piece around automotive, which there was a lot of discussion of in the meeting in the Oval Office. And so this is not by any stretch of the imagination a conclusion of the Canada-U.S. trade tensions. But when you begin to reduce the pile of irritants and you begin to get positive outcomes, that builds momentum towards a bigger, more comprehensive arrangement.
The rapport between leaders is key, particularly when you're talking about this U.S. president, I think, more than most. We'll play a clip now for you and our listeners of what the U.S. president said earlier about Prime Minister Carney.
He's a world-class leader. He's a man that knows what he wants. And I'm not surprised to see that he won the election and won it substantially. And I would think he's more popular now. He's a good man. He does a great job, and he's a tough negotiator.
Our listeners have certainly heard and are knowledgeable about the pressure on Canada's prime minister to get a deal on trade done and get these tariffs removed, if at all possible. But the climate under which the U.S. president is operating right now, how would you describe that and how that factored into how today's talks went?
Well, certainly Canada is very important to the United States. Donald Trump has stated wrongly over previous months that we don't need Canadian oil, we don't need this or that from Canada. But what you're seeing here is a prime minister who is clearly respected by the president of the United States, realizing or at least advancing a very positive strategy. And the one thing to keep in mind that's really fundamental here is that Prime Minister Carney is trying to get a better deal than any other leader in the world. Every other major economy, from the European Union to Japan to Korea, agreed to non-reciprocity in terms of tariffs. Prime Minister Carney is trying to ensure a genuine level of reciprocity, to ensure a continued ability of Canadian companies to compete. And so that's a much harder lift. And so to have the President of the United States come out in this context and direct his cabinet secretaries to start making deals on individual sectors, that is something that should be viewed very positively. And I think is a credit to the prime minister and his negotiating skills.
So you see a win here?
Well, I see the makings of a win here. It's not a win until the deal gets brought home.
And they're certainly in the United States feeling the impact on their economy of what Donald Trump has done so far. Next year's midterms, some point out, are a factor as well. From where you sit, are those driving forces for this administration and specifically in its dealings with Canada at this stage?
Yeah, when you see Donald Trump's advisors advising him to put out a narrative that it will be bad next year, but don't worry, it will get better the year after, it means that they are genuinely worried about the direction of the economy. And in my visits here in Mexico City, I've spoken to major U.S. manufacturers that have been paying more than $1 billion in tariffs so far this year. And this has meant that money is not available to build new factories, and that existing factories are not as profitable, and workers have gotten laid off. And so given the importance and the integration of Canada with the United States, if that relationship truly went south, you would see widespread negative consequences for the U.S. economy and for many individual sectors. And so what Donald Trump is trying to do is to ensure that really one of the largest trading partners that the United States has is not seeing its arrangements fall to pieces. Canada knows a lot of this. And so what it's trying to do is to play on Donald Trump's perhaps newfound willingness to negotiate and strike a deal that is reasonable, certainly starting with the three sectors identified by Minister LeBlanc.
So a shift here, some tangible results or things to take away, building towards what could be a win, as you said. But for Canadians who don't agree with Prime Minister Carney's tactics at this point, his political critics who might be running out of patience, what would you say to them?
Well, what I would say to them is that the prime minister is attempting to negotiate the hardest trade agreement that any world leader has attempted to negotiate with Donald Trump, and that Prime Minister Carney, nor any other political leader in Canada, does not have a magic wand that can be waved and to convince Donald Trump to back off of his strategy, if you can put it that way, around tariffs. And so we have to use the classic Canadian advantages of continuing to work hard, continuing to push for an agreement. And it will take as long as it will take. And yes, in this news cycle or the next news cycle or in this sitting of the House of Commons, there will be criticism. But what the prime minister is ultimately banking on is that you get a good deal in the end and everybody forgets how the sausage was made.
We shall see. Eric, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eric Miller is an international trade consultant and the president of Rideau Potomac Strategy Group. We reached him in Mexico City. Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, the leaders of the so-called Freedom Convoy, aren't exactly free today, but they aren't going to jail either. Earlier this year, Mr. Barber was found guilty of counseling others to disobey a court order. Both he and Ms. Leach were convicted of mischief for their role in organizing the 2022 protests against vaccine mandates in Ottawa. And today they were each given an 18-month conditional sentence, including 12 months under house arrest. It's another major milestone in a saga that saw the federal government invoke the Emergency Act, led to the resignation of Ottawa's police chief, and resulted in some 80 criminal investigations and multiple civil suits. Lawrence Greenspan is the lawyer for Tamara Leach. We reached him in Ottawa.
Lawrence, how is your client feeling about today's news?
Well, she's relieved, firstly. Glad that at least this part of the process is over. The Crown, as you may be aware, was seeking a 7-year penitentiary term, and our goal was to ensure that she did not spend one more day in jail, and we were able to achieve that. So she's relieved.
Yeah. This is not the 7-year sentence in prison that the Crown was pushing for, no. As you've said. It's also not the absolute discharge that you were pushing for. What stood out to you about the judge's reasoning in the end today in issuing this sentence?
Well, she recognized, Her Honor recognized that Tamara has no criminal record. She's a grandmother, a mother. Most importantly, the message that she communicated throughout the Freedom Convoy was one of, come to Ottawa and participate in the Freedom Convoy and do so peacefully and lawfully. Also, there were efforts by her, there were direct efforts between Tamara and the mayor of Ottawa to try and reduce the footprint of the protest, and that would mean reduce the impact that it was having on the residents and the businesses in the downtown core. So all of that was taken into account, that's why the judge was able to impose a conditional sentence order, house arrest, basically, in lieu of what she referred to as the excessive penitentiary sentence that the Crown was seeking.
The Crown, as you know, reiterated the harm, the concerns that this 3-week protest caused for people living in downtown Ottawa. Ottawa resident Zexy Lee helped launch a class action lawsuit, as you know, against the organizers, the convoy organizers, back in 2022, and spoke with CBC News at the time about what she and others living in downtown Ottawa were experiencing. We'll play a clip of that for you and our listeners.
I think it is lost on a lot of people the extent of the suffering that was inflicted upon the residents of Centretown, especially in the first 10 days of this occupation, an occupation that has been illegal from the start. The constant sound torture was incredibly distressing for myself, but for many other residents who may suffer from mental illness, who have certain conditions, and even babies and young children, the suffering that was inflicted was absolutely unacceptable, and it was consistently diminished by all levels of law enforcement and government for far too long.
Ms. Lee is an Ottawa resident, part of a civil suit against protest organizers, including your client, Ms. Leach. That class action has yet to be certified, but it's seeking close to $300 million in damages. So what will that mean for your client?
Well, Ms. Lee's concerns were something that we were prepared to admit at the very beginning of the trial without the necessity of having her come to court and testifying. We said, look, there's no question that there was a disturbance and that it lasted for 3 weeks and that the residents and the businesses in downtown Ottawa suffered as a result. That's never been the issue here. What the issue is whether you use the criminal law mm-hmm. as a way of dealing with that, or do you, in this case, there's a class action where damages for the very things that she's talking about, that class action is designed to try and get those individuals and businesses compensation. That's exactly what we say that's where they should be going, to get remediation for what happened. When it comes to the Freedom Convoy protest, it cannot be in Canada that freedom of expression, which encourages people to demonstrate peacefully and lawfully, that is somehow overcome by the right to enjoyment of property. It just can't be. And the reason I say that is because freedom of expression and peaceful assembly are both constitutionally protected fundamental freedoms. Nowhere does the Charter of Rights and Freedoms speak about the right to enjoyment of property. And in a battle between those two freedom and rights, the freedom of expression and peaceful assembly should win every time.
Some of the other defendants named in that civil suit have requested the trial be moved from Ottawa to Toronto, given the likelihood that court staff in Ottawa would themselves have been impacted in some way by the convoy. That request was denied. What kind of impact do you think that might have?
I wouldn't even speculate on that. There's been a, if they wanted to have it moved to Toronto, you know, so be it. And the judge obviously rejected that motion. So, I mean, that'll be up to the class action.
You live in Ottawa as well, as people may know, and you've represented all sorts of people in your career. What have you heard from neighbors and friends about this client and your decision to defend her?
It's been the fan mail and the letters of support have overwhelmingly been in favor of defending freedom of expression and the peaceful assembly in this case on behalf of Tamara Leach and Chris Barber. It's been an absolute privilege to represent her. She's a wonderful person and was advocating nothing but peaceful assembly and the fact that she's been found guilty of mischief for that. It's not a good day for Canada and fundamental freedoms.
Lawrence Greenspan, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Very welcome.
Lawrence Greenspan is the lawyer for Freedom Convoy organizer Tamara Leach. We reached him in Ottawa. It's called CHA-1107-7626, a scientific name that is either deeply significant or an in-joke to people who are smarter than me, but which does not in the slightest suggest how unusual it is. CHA-1107-7626 is a rogue planet, larger than Jupiter, that's 620 light-years away, and it has been devouring gas and dust at a record-breaking rate. In a press statement that's more of a press understatement, the European Southern Observatory described it as an enormous growth spurt. Victor Almendros Abad is an astronomer at the Astronomical Observatory of Palermo and the lead author of a study on the rogue planet that was published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters last week. We reached him in Palermo, Italy.
Victor, this all started with a moment, as these discoveries often do. You were going through some data earlier this year, and then you spotted something that looked a bit unusual.
Yeah, we had data coming in March and April, and everything looked in place. There were some minor technical issues, so when the new data came at the end of June, I went quickly to check it just to see whether the technical issue was solved. And I saw that there was definitely something different, and I left it to think for a few days, and then I shared it with my colleagues, and we started following it up. It was really exciting because this was the first time that such an event was found, and we were initially expecting it to be pretty short-lived, and then we found that it continued for a few months.
So it kept going and going. We're going to get further into your findings, but let's get into something else. First of all, what is a rogue planet?
Yeah, so this object is about 5 to 10 times the mass of Jupiter. So you can think of it as a very big planet, a very big Jupiter. So that's why we refer to as this kind of object. We typically refer to it as a planetary mass object. Mm-hmm. But the difference with planets is that it's not orbiting a star. So we find this object floating freely. That's why we call it rogue planet, or more technically, we call it free-floating planetary mass object.
If we were able to stand on it, what would it that environment be like? You talked about the size, the mass, but what would it be like to stand on it?
That's a very interesting question. It's not something that I've thought about. I mean, in general, you should think about it as something similar to Jupiter, mm-hmm. but at the same time, this is something much younger. So this is object is around 1 to 2 million years old compared to Jupiter, which is a couple thousand millions of years old. So it's much older. So it's still much hotter because of the formation. So it will be much hotter. But it also has something that it's partly what we are studying. It has this protoplanetary disk that we called, that you can imagine it as some kind of frisbee around the object, that its material is gas and dust, that it's remnant of the formation of the object.
And so that frisbee is where it's consuming everything that's helping it grow?
Yeah, so that's exactly it. Right now, this object is at the later stages of formation, so it has its final mass will be very similar to what it has today. But it still has this remnant material that's still being fed into the central object, which is what we are observing.
And what kinds of things is it consuming? What is it in its diet?
It's gas. Mainly it's gas.
So have you ever observed, or has anyone ever observed, something at this speed, growing at this speed?
Yeah, so these kinds of phenomena in which you have sudden bursts of material coming in from this frisbee or this disk into the central object in stars. So this is something that we think that must be fundamental in the early evolution of stars, these sudden episodes of accretion of material. But it had never been observed in such a low mass object. And why this is very interesting is because, as I was saying before, this object is not exactly a planet. So this is what actually brings us to this kind of studies, to understand what is this object. Is this a very, very low mass star-like object that has formed from the collapse of some material, or has it formed around the planet? So what we are studying is whether there's similarities in the processes affecting these objects.
I've seen the animation that comes with your study, and when you look at that, yeah, you probably don't want to stand on it. It's quite vivid and mesmerizing, actually, to look at it. But when you talk about the speed, how fast is this going? How quickly? And it's also great that you've described this as a growth spurt, and it's a young, almost teenager like rogue planet. So how quickly is it consuming things?
Yeah, so I think in the official press release, they said some order of magnitude in tons per second. We typically refer to these speeds in terms of relative to the mass of the central object, so that it gives you an idea of how important this is. So in this particular event, it only accreted around 1/1,000,000,000 of its current mass. So it's really a very non-significant event. But what is very interesting, that's obviously our next step here, is because if these kinds of events are very common and they are long lasting, because we just have an estimation of the length, we don't know whether it's still going on or not, and then these kinds of events must be really important in the early life of these objects.
We've said the name of this rogue planet. Do you say that name every time you talk about it, or have you guys all come up with a nickname?
No, we don't have a nickname. We normally refer to it in text, so we don't have to say it. When we talk about it, we are talking about the object.
The object. Very special, special object. How much more of your time do you think this object will consume?
Oh, let's see. Depends whether it keeps being exciting or not. Right now, as I was saying, our plan is to try to understand how common is these kinds of events. So we will definitely keep looking at it. It depends on whether the rest of the scientific community thinks that it's interesting to keep following up, because all of these kinds of observations need to be approved by the community.
Right.
So we'll see if it keeps surprising us with if more exciting stuff that's going on there, then we will keep going looking at it for a few more years.
Victor, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Of course, thanks to you.
That was astronomer Victor Almendros Abad in Palermo, Italy.
It's back, the Double Steak Grilled Cheese Burrito, only at Taco Bell.
It's all for you.
Stick with the burrito experts, Taco Bell's Grande Scrambler.
It's the $5 Grande Crunchwrap meal, only at Taco Bell.
The Taco Bell bell, as synonymous with that fast food brand as the sounds of hunger in your stomach before you eat it and the sounds of confusion in your stomach after you eat it. Now, that bong is supposed to feel fun, and I guess it does, until you run the Taco Bell Ultra Marathon. No one asked me how long it took to make this. Now, if the world were fair, you would never have to know about the International Taco Bell 50K Ultra Marathon. 5 minutes from now, if someone asked how you were doing, you'd be able to say, fine. If the world were fair, you would sleep tonight. But the world is not fair, so I'm sorry, but you're going to learn about the International Taco Bell 50K Ultra Marathon. I'm really sorry. This past weekend, the 8th annual edition of this race took place in Denver. The rules are straightforward, in the sense that getting punched in the gut is straightforward. You run 50 kilometers, during which you stop in at 10 different Taco Bell locations. You have to eat at 9 of them. And you can't just nibble a dry tortilla. By the fourth stop, you have to have eaten a Crunchwrap Supreme or a Chalupa Supreme, or you're disqualified. By the eighth stop, you have to have eaten a Burrito Supreme, about 400 calories, or Nachos Bel Grande, about 700 calories. Quote, entrants must keep all receipts and wrappers for confirmation of stupidity at the end of the run, unquote. And you're not allowed to take an antacid at any point. I don't know who won the International Taco Bell 50K Ultra Marathon on Sunday, and I don't know what they won, but I know what they lost, their dignity and their innocence. And given how much Taco Bell they ate, I'm assuming it wasn't the border they made a run for. Here's Yerba Buena with El Burrito.
Yo lo que quiero es un burrito que me lleve lejos. Un avioncito que me huele lejos, que me huele. No te preocupes, sigue tu camino y deja que te lleve el destino. Si tú sientes que no puedes respirar, es que algo bueno está por pasar. No te preocupes si sientes un vacío y a veces hasta te crees perdido. Si tú sabes lo que quieres alcanzar, no hay nada que te pueda parar.
Yerba Buena with El Burrito.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, we will remember Dennis Trudeau, who sat in this chair as the co-host of As It Happens as part of a long and illustrious career with CBC.
We've pulled some of his old interviews from the archives, including a conversation with Winnie Mandela. We'll also talk to his former colleague, producer Julian Scher, who will remember Dennis's sincerity, his endless curiosity, and his love of a great story. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Recuerda que tú sabes la verdad. Si aparezco en uno de tus sueños, recíbeme, no tengas miedo. Si no entiendes cuando canto Yoruba, no te mandarán.
for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Eric Otto is your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from North Holmes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northholmes.org. It's Fall Flannel Fest at historic Colival Hall in Virginia this Saturday. Sloppy Joe's will be served starting at 5 o'clock and music from the Lindela Brothers from 6 to 8. Proceeds benefit the preservation of the hall. And Lake Bemidji State Park has a Fall Fest candlelight adventure this Saturday evening from 6:30 to 8. Take a short candlelit hike to the Lavinia Group Camp for a campfire and stop by the Visitor Center for a craft, treats, games, and animals. Costumes are encouraged. Thanks for listening to KAXE. There's more ahead from As It Happens.
The U.S. government shutdown is in its seventh day, and millions of families don't know how long they'll be able to put food on the table. When Republicans and Democrats failed to reach an agreement on a spending bill last week, it prevented the renewal of federal funding to several agencies, including the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, also known as WIC. It provides food vouchers to mothers to help them buy fresh produce, baby formula, other household staples. For now, it's running on a contingency fund, but without federal money, the agency says that fund could run out by next week. Barbie Anderson is a mother of three who receives that federal food assistance. We reached her in Malacca, Minnesota.
Barbie, this funding has not been cut off yet, but the threat of it being cut off is very real, I know, for you and so many other families across the United States. So knowing that that threat is there, what has that meant over the past few days for you?
It has been a lot, very stressful. We don't know where our benefits are. Our benefits end on October 14th. So if the government doesn't come back on, I don't know where we're going to be at that time.
Yeah. Are you getting any communication from the people you normally deal with for, you know, getting this funding?
So through the app, they have sent out a communication just saying WIC is good through October. Keep using your benefits. We'll keep you updated.
So what does that mean practically for you in terms of what you're putting on the table even tonight?
We are trying to stretch our dollars, minimizing milk right now and stretching our oranges and fruit and vegetables because we don't know on the 14th if we're going to be able to get our benefits.
How long do you think you can keep stretching?
Not very long. We are trying the best that we can, but we can't stretch it much further than what we already have.
Your children are small, 3, 6, and 9 years old. Is that right?
Yes.
And do they have a sense of what's going on?
No, they do not. Yeah. We've always been frugal with what we put on the table and everything just because the money situation isn't the best. But yeah, they've noticed, you know, milk is a little bit less this time. And, you know, we've tried to have conversations, but they don't really, I don't think, comprehend.
Yeah. How does having this benefit, you know, when you think back to years past when you didn't have WIC funding, what was it like then? How has it changed things for you and your family to have it?
It has changed quite a bit. We don't get too much on WIC, but enough to get us by. You know, the extra milk and the fruit and vegetables are huge. We use a lot of the fruit and vegetables for oranges and stuff, especially with the kids in school to keep their immune system up. So it means a lot to us, just this extra little bit that we can get.
Yeah, and so it these benefits allow you to buy the basics, essentially, right?
Yep, it's just the basics.
And how does the benefit work for people who haven't heard of it before?
So the benefit, it gets loaded onto like a card and you get certain amounts. So you get like one peanut butter, one so much money in fruit and vegetables. You get like 2 gallons of milk or thing of eggs, some cheese, some cereal, and then like a bread. And you go into the store and you just get the specific what is on the WIC. So, you know, on the WIC card, instead of spending $5 for a gallon of milk, we get it free. Right. So that means a lot.
Yeah. And on top of that, you also live in a rural area. What does that mean in terms of access to the kind of fresh food, fruits and vegetables and food that ideally you want?
So our closest grocery store is like 22 minutes away from us, and it's very expensive. The price of milk is $5. And they can keep it that way because they're the only grocery store around. We do not have access to a Walmart, Target, any bigger stores that you can get for, say, cheaper groceries, products.
Yeah. And if the shutdown continues, are you going to have to drive to those towns that have the bigger stores?
Yep, we'll probably have to drive 45 minutes each way there and back to a Walmart, which would be the closest, to get what we need.
So even if it's cheaper, there's obviously the cost of that time and the gas.
Yes. Gas, yep.
You're thinking about your little ones, obviously, and making sure they're taken care of. What about you and your husband? Like, how are you doing with all of this uncertainty and calculations and budgeting and rebudgeting?
It's a little bit stressful. Just not knowing if we're going to have that or not is, you know, it puts some hardship on us.
Do you think the politicians, Republicans and Democrats, you know, trying to agree on a funding bill that's what's at the heart of this government shutdown, do you think they understand what this shutdown means for you and families like yours?
No, I do not. We don't qualify for a lot of things because we make like $82 extra a month to not qualify for certain things. So WIC is the only thing that we have. And I don't think they really understand you're hurting the middle class, and they don't understand what they're doing to the kids. I mean, if we don't have our oranges and stuff to feed our kids, they're going to be sick, and then they're going to be pulled out of school because you can't send sick kids to school, and then they're going to be truant, and it's just going to be a downward effect.
What would you say to them if you were if you were there in Washington speaking directly to the leaders that are bickering at this point?
I would say, you know, put your blinders off and actually put yourself in someone's shoes. I know it's hard to do, but if you really just think about it and feel what we're going through, you know, we don't have much. We're trying to scrape by. And if you just put yourself in our shoes, it's, you know, maybe you would see it at a different point of view.
Even if the shutdown ends, you know, are you worried that funding for WIC might be cut anyway?
Yeah. And, you know, not only that, everything else is going up higher. You got healthcare, your everyday essentials are going higher, and you just don't know what's going to happen in the world.
Well, Barbie, I hope you and your family get answers soon. Thank you for this. I appreciate it. Please take care.
Thank you.
Barbie Anderson is a mother of three who receives federal funds to buy food. We reached her in Malacca, Minnesota. Today, in a combative hearing, United States Attorney General Pam Bondi faced some sharp questioning from Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Tension has been high since the administration decided to deploy National Guard troops to several U.S. cities, all of them governed by Democrats. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin pressed Ms. Bondi on the move, and she pushed back.
Madam Attorney General, let me ask you this question. Were you consulted by the White House before they deployed National Guard troops to cities in the United States?
I am not going to discuss any internal conversations with the White House.
You won't even say whether you talked to the White House about this?
I am not going to discuss any internal conversations with the White House with you, Chair, Ranking Member.
I noticed that. What's the secret? Why do you want to keep this secret? The American people don't know the rationale behind the deployment of National Guard troops in my state. The word is, and I think it's been confirmed by the White House, they are going to transfer Texas National Guard units to the state of Illinois. What's the rationale for that?
Yeah, Chairman, as you shut down the government, you voted to shut down the government, and you're sitting here, our law enforcement officers aren't being paid. They're out there working to protect you. I wish you loved Chicago as much as you hate President Trump. And currently, the National Guard are on the way to Chicago. If you're not going to protect your citizens, President Trump will.
I've been on this committee for more than 20 years. That's the kind of testimony you expect from this administration. A simple question as to whether or not they had a legal rationale for deploying National Guard troops becomes grounds for a personal attack. I think it's a legitimate question. It's my responsibility. She refuses to answer as to whether she had any conversation with the White House about deploying national troops to my state. That's an indication, I'm afraid, where we are politically in this place.
The National Guard is on the way right now as we speak. Oh, by the way, so is Director Patel and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche. You're sitting here grilling me, and they're on their way to Chicago to keep your state safe.
Madam Attorney General, it's my job to grill you. Investigation of your agency is part of my responsibility and this committee. You may not like the experience, but others have weathered the storm and answered questions in a respectful manner.
Illinois Senator Dick Durbin and Attorney General Pam Bondi during a hearing in Washington today. When you work it as it happens, you're constantly confronted with the legacy of a program that's been on for nearly 60 years now. And sometimes it's quite literally staring you in the face in the form of a large black and white portrait hanging near the printer in our newsroom. It shows a handsome man with a period-appropriate stylish silver mullet and a truly heroic mustache over a wide smile. That's Dennis Trudeau, who hosted As It Happens in the middle of the 1980s. Mr. Trudeau died this week. He was 77. Like anyone who hosts this program, he spent every day pivoting between high-stakes conversations with world leaders or the latest economic outlook and stuff like this.
Mr. Harrison, this is, above all, summertime ice cream season. Tell us, how do we do it properly? How do we taste ice cream properly?
Well, above all, we have to enjoy ice cream, and we can get involved in it in so many different ways, but I'm paid to taste ice cream, and what I look for when I taste ice cream is very similar to wine tasting. In wine tasting, of course, you start with the lightest flavors, the white wines, and you work your way down to the heavy type flavors, the Bordeaux's or the mint chip and the New York blueberry cheesecake ice creams.
New York blueberry cheesecake?
Dennis Trudeau discovering new ice cream flavors with John Harrison on As It Happens in 1986. Before his time here, and for many years afterwards, he covered the news in Montreal, hosting local TV and radio programs. Julian Scher is an investigative journalist, producer, and author, and a former colleague of Dennis Trudeau's in Montreal. That's where we reached him.
Julian, that voice will evoke different things for a lot of people, but what does that voice evoke for you?
It evokes Dennis's curiosity, his endless, you know, search for answers. And it could be something as light as ice cream, or when we were working together on radio, it could be sports interviews or poets, but also going doggedly after reluctant politicians or anybody who was trying to hide the truth. And that was so, it's I'm so moved just hearing his voice again, right? It just you know, sings through the radio. And he could convey that curiosity to people. People listening knew that Dennis was interested and interested in telling stories. So he was wonderful to work with.
We never had a chance to meet, unfortunately, but everyone I've spoken to who did work with him and know him talks about him being a journalist. Like he loved journalism. How would you describe him?
He was. I mean, look, talk about time travel. I worked with Dennis back in the 1980s. That was before computers came into the newsrooms, before the internet. So we would type up the scripts. I mean, this is like 5 a.m. in the morning, right, for the morning show. And he'd, on carbon paper, and he'd be scribbling and changing words with his pen in the studio just before we got to air, because he wanted every word to be right. You know, he wanted every question to be pointed. And he loved the hunt. He loved the chase. You know, when you're doing morning radio or As It Happens, and later on he moved to TV, you have to be able to pivot on a moment's notice, right? What I loved about Dennis, too, is that he was like a journalistic piano player, uh-huh. right? He loved going after, you know, the politicians. Yeah. But I remember that was also the era when AIDS first hit. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of hatred and fear. And we on television at one point held a public community forum. And Dennis was great at building those bridges and reaching out to people.
In terms of those political interviews, there are many to choose from, but we chose one from As It Happens, of course. He's speaking, Dennis Trudeau is, with Progressive Conservative MP at the time, François Gérin, a member of Brian Mulroney's government, and he was embroiled in a fundraising scandal at the time. Have a listen.
Mr. Gérin, now that the Tory caucus from Quebec has made its recommendations to the Prime Minister about cleaning up your party and your government's act, how much time does the Prime Minister have?
Well, I don't know. You better to ask him this question. But I'll say that he better to take a decision pretty soon.
What do you mean by pretty soon?
Well, I mean before Easter, for sure. But I hope next week or the week after.
Why?
Well, because it's an urgent problem. We have to restore this public image that doesn't permit us to deal with the real Canadian problems right now. So I don't mean that it's not an important problem, this bad perception of our image, but we have also to govern Canada.
Doesn't it look, though, a bit like a deathbed conversion?
What do you hear in that last comment in particular?
You know, I train journalists around the world now in how to do interviews. And look at what Dennis does, right? He listens to the words the person speaks, right? And turns those words against them, right? He doesn't suffer fools gladly. And he knows what people want to know. So he pushes people, right? And I think we're missing a lot of that more and more in journalism today and around the world. Frankly, there's a lot of attacks, of course, on the media, and Dennis just represented that balance and fairness, but not being afraid of standing up to power.
Mm-hmm. He was known to be tough, you know, for the younger people who worked with him. They admired and respected him, but they said he was tough as well. Do you remember that side of him, or did he ever talk about that with you?
I do. There were times when, you know, there was a glass window between me and Dennis. I was the producer, and I could still hear him yelling. You know? But, you know, because he didn't suffer any kind of fools gladly, right? He wanted to be right. He wanted to make sure that we were pushing ourselves as much as possible. And I think people appreciated that, you know? And yet there was always, and especially when he moved to television, you know, he left As It Happens, came back to Montreal, and we worked together on television. And he had that twinkle in his eyes, you know, and that smile, even if he was going to, you know, throw a killer question at you.
Was it hard for him to make that transition? His As It Happens co-host, Al Maitland, a legend in his own right, of course, joked about how they'd only managed to keep him away from Montreal for so long. So he really did want to get back to Quebec and to Montreal. But that's a big transition to go from radio
television. You know, as you know, in our business, there's a standing joke, right? You have a great face for radio, right? Well, Dennis, of course, had a great voice for radio, that deep baritone voice that we just heard. But he actually had a great face for television, right? That beautiful silver hair he had, it eventually turned silver, right? that sparkle in his eyes. And I think what was great about TV is people could see see him, and they could see his curiosity. They could see his sincerity, but at the same time, you know, his when he doubted that somebody was really telling the truth, right? Or when he was importing some sad news. Look, not, you know, Dennis covered the Polytechnic massacre, right? The killing of those women when we had to go live with some of the most horrific stories. And Dennis could convey the what was going on with seriousness, with compassion. So that's what made him such a popular newscaster.
Julian, I very much appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It brings back a lot of sad memories, but I think, you know, above all, really good memories, and memories that we and all Canadians, I think, should cherish. Thanks a lot.
Julian Cher is an investigative journalist, producer and author, and a former colleague of Dennis Trudeau. And one more thing. While we were looking around in the As It Happens archives for some of Dennis's notable moments from the program, we came across this from 1985. This is Dennis Trudeau speaking with Winnie Madikizela Mandela. At the time, there were huge anti-apartheid protests in Cape Town, outside the prison where her husband, Nelson Mandela, was being held.
What's their strategy? Do they intend to make any kind of peaceful protest impossible in South Africa?
Peaceful protest is absolutely impossible now, in today's South Africa, because there is no other measure that is not regarded as illegal by the regime. Every aspect of our lives, everything we do is against the law. We cannot demonstrate, we cannot hold placards in protest. Life is virtually almost impossible. This is what we have been trying to explain to the rest of the world. I am so sorry. Could you hold on, please? I understand my daughter is holding on very urgently from Cape Town.
Very well. We'll hold on. Please come back on the line if you can, Mrs. Mandela.
Please, sir. Just hold on.
I will.
Hello?
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 Mrs. Mandela?
Hold on. She won't be long.
Okay, we're holding on.
Hello?
Hello, Mrs. Mandela.
Yes.
Thank you for coming back on the line. What did your daughter tell you about what was happening in Cape Town?
Apparently, the police, the army, is shooting people, and there are already several deaths.
Mrs. Mandela, do you ever think you will see your husband released from jail?
Certainly. I have no doubt about that. The government will be forced to release our leaders, and the government will be compelled to return our leaders who are in exile. And they will be compelled to release them on their terms, not on the government terms.
Winnie Madikizela Mandela speaking with As It Happens host Dennis Trudeau in 1985. Dennis Trudeau died this week in Montreal. He was 77.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.